Everyone to the Alaska, if I could have your attention. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Alaska World Affairs Council on this wonderful Thursday evening here. We are so pleased that everyone is coming, all of the familiar faces, as well as a lot of new faces. If you have never been to an Alaska World Affairs Council program before, ever in our 60 years in Alaska, raise your hand. Okay, there are a couple people. We are so glad that you guys came and that you finally figured out that we're here and we are putting on programs at least twice a month on amazing topics around the world and how they apply to Alaska, and we want you to come back again. So please consider coming again. We're gonna be here again this same time, same place. So next Thursday, the 31st of January, where we will be featuring Fran Ulmer, who will be talking about after the ice melts. So you don't have to go to Stanford University to hear her speak about what happens after the ice melts. You can come right here and listen to her. That's next Thursday, the 31st, 6 to 7 o'clock in the evening. We will then turn around the very next day, so that's Friday, February 1st at noon, from noon to 1, where we are going to feature Alaskan-grown Dr. Bill Von Hippel, who is now a professor in Australia, and he's doing all sorts of amazing things, and he will be speaking about evolutionary psychology and global security. So that's the next day, February 1st. We still have some seats available. You can register for that online. And then the following Friday, we're going to be back here again at noon featuring retired Marine Colonel Grant Newsham, who is going to be talking about China's plan for the Asia-Pacific region and what it means for Alaska. So you don't want to miss out on those programs. And if you register early, if anyone here registered early, we will send you a code for free parking. Easy Park wants to make it easy for everyone to come to the Alaska World Affairs Council. They said they appreciate what we're doing. And so for that, they offer free parking for anyone who comes to our programs. We'll send you the code if you register in advance. And the parking is on Easy Park, thanks to them. I want to mention one other program that's coming up here, the 12th of April, with a professor from Harvard University, Dr. Serhii Plokii, who is going to be talking about the atomic energy and the arrogance of man, revisiting the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. He has a book with the same title that is out. We have some copies if anybody wants to read the book in advance of that April 12th program. Those are in the front. And we grabbed a couple other ones of Dr. Plokii's. They just looked really, really interesting. He has a fiction book here called, that's this one, The Man with the Poison Gun, a Cold War spy story, if we have any of those Cold War lovers out there, as well as A History of Ukraine, The Gates of Europe. So we have all three books available for anyone who wants to read up a little bit and prepare for that program on the 12th of April. The World Affairs Council is supported by members, and so I want to thank everyone for becoming a member of the World Affairs Council. And if you're currently not a member of the World Affairs Council, I'd like to encourage you to consider joining. Your membership makes it possible for us to bring programs like this here today, as well as a program we did on Monday, just this past Monday, the 21st of January, called the Student Academic World Quest Competition. It's a competition we've been doing for over a decade with high school students, and teams of four from Anchorage and the Mat-Su Valley compete on topics that are really challenging. It's foreign affairs, current events, geography, and these students are really amazing, the amount of time and dedication they put to studying for this competition. The winning team of four we then send to Washington, D.C. So this year, four students from Mat-Su Career Tech are going to Washington, D.C. to compete in the national competition on April 27th. And we also have in second place a team from Chugach High School, and third place went to Eagle River High School. So we are super excited about that. So thank you for your support of the World Affairs Council and programs like that. Do we have any students today? I know this is an evening and there's a lot of homework. If you have any students, if you don't mind raising your hands, we'd like to recognize the students that are here. Fabulous. If you can join me for a round of applause for the students who are taking their time out to come here. We love having students at our programs, and we really appreciate BP for sponsoring our students. Our students can come to all programs for free thanks to BP. This is the 12th year that they have been supporting our student programs, so we are very grateful for them. And before I go into our introduction and our speakers, I'd like to encourage everyone to just put their phone on silence. You don't have to turn it off. But we have Amon Swenson from Alaska Public Media, and he is recording this program. So if you could just put that on vibrate, that'd be great for all of our radio listeners. And you can find this program, as well as all of our previous programs, on their website or ours. We have links to all of our programs on Alaska Public Media, so you can send it to your friends, or if you want to hear it again, we'll have that available for you. And while you have your phones out, feel free to follow us on the virtual sphere by following us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. We really love all the people who do that in the virtual sphere. With that, I'd like to bring to the stage Mr. David Ramser, chair of our board of directors and popular author of the book Melting the Ice Curtain, The Extraordinary Story of Citizen Diplomacy on the Russian-Alaska Frontier, to introduce our speaker, Mr. David Ramser.
Thank you, Lisa, and thanks for the plug. Good evening, everybody. Looks like we're in store for another compelling World Affairs Council program tonight. Our presentation is from a relatively new to Alaska UAA economist with an intriguing and controversial message, especially for Alaska, that resource development may not be all it's cranked up to be. Alexander James joined the UAA faculty in 2014 with a doctorate in economics from the University of Wyoming. He grew up in rural Northern California and studied resource economics at Oxford. And when he arrived here, some of his colleagues advised him to tone down his message that instead of the oil era being a good thing for Alaska, it may have made us poorer, or at least no better off. But he's got the research to support it. And we've asked one of Alaska's better informed and none too shy thinkers about oil and gas to hold Professor James' feet to the fire. Like me, Larry Pursley began his career in newspapers as a reporter, editor, and newspaper owner. And then, like me, he went to the dark side, working in state, municipal, and federal jobs focused on oil and gas issues, fiscal matters, and the state budget. But unlike me, he enjoys a stellar reputation for his insights and his knowledge. So tonight's discussion couldn't be more timely, with the new governor's State of the State address just two nights ago and the startup of a new legislature as Alaska faces enormous fiscal challenges. So please help me welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council stage UAA economics professor Alexander James and Larry Pursley.
Thank you. The format is Alexander's going to give a presentation, then afterwards I've got some questions ready and we'll take questions from the audience. Just one thing to keep in mind, his presentation tonight is on the resource curse. That's curse as a noun, not as a verb. So as you think about this and your reaction to his comments, just keep that in mind. Thank you. It's your turn.
All right, Ty. So I made a terrible mistake before coming here tonight. I was on Facebook the other day and I saw an advertisement for this event, and I made the stupid mistake of looking at the comments associated with it. So I appreciate the fact that a lot of people have a wide variety of opinions and ideas, and I commend you for coming tonight. Thank you for coming tonight and keeping an open mind about some of this stuff. Let's see. So I have about 15 minutes, 16 or 17 if I push it, to catch you guys all up to speed on about 30 years of research on the so-called curse of natural resources. Okay, so what is a resource curse? The idea of a resource curse is that the discovery of, the extraction of, the production of a natural resource can actually make economies poorer and worse off than they would have been in the absence of that extraction or production. So it's not just that the natural resource wealth is wasted or that there's no effect. It's that economies are actually worse off because of the extraction. Now, the other thing I want to point out here at the beginning is that this is not just an academic question that's debated on campuses. This is a question and an idea that's debated by, yes, academics, but the general public, but also policymakers regionally, locally, nationally, internationally. So this is a big idea that's really important. Now, it's a perplexing idea, right? So if you think about, in Econ 101, we teach our students that natural resources are a form of capital, like physical capital or human capital, education. Even if you don't use the natural resources in the production process, you can export the natural resources and use the proceeds to invest in schooling and healthcare and infrastructure development, and these things should fuel long-run growth and development. And yet, if we look around the world, anecdotal examples abound of places that are very dependent upon natural resources and yet suffer from a variety of bad economic and political outcomes, right? So South America, Venezuela, a bunch of examples in Africa, Algeria, Nigeria, the DRC, the Republic of the Congo, Asia, Southeast Asia, Papua New Guinea. These places are very dependent upon natural resources, meaning a large percentage of the stuff they produce is a primary product. These places are not just poor. Resource-dependent countries suffer from lower levels of education attainment, right? Worse health outcomes, lower life expectancy, increased infant mortality. Most notably, these resource-dependent economies grow slowly. So this figure is taken from a seminal paper on the resource curse written by Jeffrey Sachs and Andrew Warner. And I think it might be, some people in the back might not be able to see this, but this horizontal axis is resource dependence, the percentage of total production in a country that's a primary product in 1970. And then on the vertical axis is per capita income growth from 1970 to 1990. And so clearly there's a negative relationship here. The economies that the countries that were most dependent upon natural resources in 1970 not only grew more slowly than those economies that were less dependent upon natural resources, but they grew at a negative rate. This number here is negative 2 right here. So Liberia, Saudi Arabia, Zambia, they were growing at maybe a negative 2% average annual rate from 1970 to 1990. Which means every year they were consuming 2% less stuff, right? So why might this happen? There's a bunch of theories that have been proposed. The most notable and famous one, I think, is something called the Dutch disease. Without getting into too much detail, the Dutch disease works when the extraction of a natural resource shrinks the size of other sectors in an economy. So shrinks the size of, say, in particular, manufacturing, right? So it's named after the experience in the Netherlands when natural gas was discovered in the northern part of the country in the late 50s, early 60s. And this line here, this is manufacturing employment over time. And that red line marks the date at which natural gas started to be produced in the Netherlands. And what we see is that employment in manufacturing was trending upwards. Then natural gas started to be produced, and employment in manufacturing was, the trend was permanently shifted negative. However, we see the same trend for the UK, we see the same trend for Germany, we see the same trend for Belgium and for France, and the list goes on. And the reason I bring all of this up is because I think that this, you know, mixed evidence or weak evidence of a Dutch disease is emblematic of a lot of the resource curse literature, that actually a lot of the purported evidence fails under more scrutiny. So another theory is that natural resource-dependent economies suffer from volatility. Volatility is bad for growth. Resource-dependent economies are more volatile. There you have it. In a key examination of the effect of volatility on economic growth, resource-induced volatility, Vanderplug and Pollock conclude that our key message is thus that volatility is a quintessential feature of the resource curse. So volatility might be playing a really key, important role here. Political corruption, right? So beyond economic effects, there's a variety of really interesting ideas and theories that explain why the production or dependence upon natural resources might cause governments to be corrupt. And corruption has is linked with a whole load of bad economic outcomes, including slow growth. Violence and conflict. There's reasons to think natural resources can both cause conflict to occur and also increase the length at which conflict lasts. So this is a story, you know, most notably, I think, in Sierra Leone. There's a movie about it with Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Connelly. It's a pretty good movie. But the movie's about diamonds in Sierra Leone, right? And the role that diamonds played in the civil war there. ISIS was recently named by Forbes magazine as the top 10 richest terrorist organization in the world. Part of their wealth comes from the fact that they control oil fields, and they sell the oil to fund their operations. Coca price shocks has been linked to violence in Colombia. The shale boom in the lower 48 has been linked to a variety of violence and criminal activity in the lower 48. Natural resources have even been linked to a variety of bad education outcomes. So it's both supply side and demand side effects, right? So if for whatever reason, and we can talk about maybe in more detail later on why this might be the case, but if people decide not to go to school, when they live in a resource-rich economy, well, there's going to be long-run problems for growth there. Now, I'm actually, this is going to surprise a lot of you, I'm actually a skeptic of the resource curse, right? So I actually think that each one of these potential explanations here have existed before, and they will exist again in the future. But the key question is what happens on average? So on average, when a resource is extracted or discovered, should we expect conflict to break out? Should we expect bad education outcomes to ensue? And I actually think not, ironically, because the purported evidence for a resource curse is so robust, right? So it's not just that countries dependent upon natural resources grow slowly. Even U.S. states dependent upon natural resources grow slowly. And U.S. counties that are dependent upon natural resources grow slowly. And civil war didn't break out in North Dakota when we started fracking down there, right? So there's something else going on, perhaps. And I actually think that that a lot of the purported evidence of a resource curse is due to a statistical artifact. It's misinterpretation of results. So what explains the inverse relationship, the negative relationship between resource dependence and economic growth? I actually think it's something called a resource drag. And a resource drag exists when, you know, suppose that there's an economy humming along according to this green line, and then they discover an exhaustible natural resource like oil. And we start extracting the oil out of the ground, well, income levels rise, but then we start to run out. And income levels start to return to where they would have been had that resource never been discovered, right? So if you agree to give me $1 million next year, and then the year after that you give me 900,000, and then 800,000, and 700,000, I will experience significant negative growth in income. But I would be okay if anybody wants to do that. I would prefer that, right? And so the point here is that what matters, what's key, is income levels, not income growth. And a resource discovery can simultaneously create higher income levels and also slow growth. All right, now, I think that this actually explains why resource-dependent economies, whether it's counties or countries, grow slowly. What explains why resource-dependent economies suffer from low life expectancy, poverty, low education attainment? I think that it's reverse causality, that it's a statistical artifact. That, you know, what's the difference between Saudi Arabia and the United States? It's not oil production. We produce roughly equivalent quantities of oil. The difference between these two countries, Saudi Arabia and the United States, is non-oil production. We produce $19 trillion worth of other stuff. The GDP of Saudi Arabia is roughly the size of Pennsylvania, right? And so in some sense, natural resources might provide the only sector that an economy can rely on. It's the only surviving sector, right? So if an economy doesn't have a robust service sector, doesn't have a robust manufacturing sector, they're dependent upon the only thing they have, right? So in this sense, it's the poverty, it's the bad institutions, it's the lack of education that's causing the dependence on oil or natural resources, not the other way around. So we need to be really careful with how we measure natural resources when we're trying to investigate whether or not a resource curse exists. And in light of some of these statistical issues, economists have more recently used more sophisticated techniques to estimate the long-run effect of resource discoveries and production. So this is one example. Medexa, 2012, he estimates the long-run effects on GDP per capita, average income, for Norway. So this dotted line is what he predicts income in Norway would have been in the absence of oil production. This green line is actual income per capita in Norway. The difference between these two lines gives the so-called treatment effect. It's the effect on income per capita of oil production. So we see big long-run gains for Norway. Brock Smith, a good friend of mine, he did the same type of analysis for a variety of countries, and he finds some mixed evidence, right? So Republic of the Congo and Botswana, Denmark, he estimates large long-run income benefits of oil. But for Algeria, because remember, this is actual income per capita in Algeria. This is where he estimates it would have been in the absence of natural resources. He finds a different effect for that country. Within the United States, Jacobson and Parker look at the effect of being an oil-rich county before, during, and after the oil price boom in the late 70s and early 1980s. And so the key here is, if you look at this black line here, this is the effect of being an oil-rich county in each particular year, right? So in the late 1970s, when the oil price boomed, average income in oil-producing counties in the lower 48 boomed. And when the price came back down in the early 1980s, so did the average income level. But what's interesting here is that he finds that income doesn't return to where it would have been. It actually is less than where it would have been. So average income levels lower, they conclude, in the long run as a result of the oil boom. They find similar results for the unemployment rate, that there's more unemployment in the long run as a result of this oil boom. This is a figure taken from a paper that has garnered some attention here in Alaska. This is my estimate of what income in Alaska, average income per person, would have looked like in the absence of discovering Prudhoe Bay. So this solid line is actual income per capita in Alaska. And I want you to note something particular here, that when the pipeline was built, when it started in 74, income per capita boomed in Alaska. It was maybe 30% higher, 35% higher than it otherwise would have been. But then Alaska, we experienced zero or negative growth in income per capita for the next like 20 years, right? And eventually my estimate of where Alaska would have been in the absence of Prudhoe Bay caught up to us, or not me, I just got here, but you guys. And in fact, by the late 1990s and early 2000s, I predict that actually average income level in Alaska might have been a little bit higher had we not discovered Prudhoe Bay. But by the mid to late 2000s, when oil prices came back up, we returned back to right about exactly where we probably would have been in terms of average income levels. All right. So to conclude this bombardment of information, is there a resource curse? Yes, sometimes it's not destiny, though. And I don't think that that's the right question. That's not the right question that Alaskans or other people should be asking. We should be asking, when is there a resource curse? And more broadly, what can we do to harness this short-run boom that's generated by resource discovery and turn it into long-run growth and progress? That's it.
Thank you. Before we go to audience questions, I'll give you an easy one.
Thank you.
So you talk, it's not that easy. You talked about volatility with a resource-based economy. We've certainly seen that in Alaska. When oil prices are high and the money flows, we pig out on an endless list of stupid projects. And then when oil prices go down, we say, oh my God, the world's falling. We've got to shut schools and stop paying troopers on the highway. So if you were governor and... Well, it's not open, but it'll be open again in 4 years. If you were governor and you can't change the past, but you looked at it and said, okay, this is how you've dealt with it so far, and you want to moderate that volatility, you want to make things stronger going ahead, what would you do in Alaska's case, and would an income tax be an option? And that I read that in one of your interviews as a way to sort of reduce that volatility and make it a better economy. So that's the question.
So if I was governor, I would start by saying Alaska's greatest resource is its people.
Oh, geez, guy's running for office already.
And while I wasn't born in Alaska, I got here as soon as I could.
Yeah. Okay. But and children are our most important resource, right, too. Right. Remember that.
So the question was about volatility. What can we do to minimize the volatility? So there's a couple of things. I think the best thing to do is build a wealth fund that doesn't work just as a savings account, but works as a smoothing device, right? So you could imagine, and the devil's always in the details, I know, but you could imagine a situation where the state of Alaska takes its $4 billion or $8 billion, whatever its budget is, out of a pot of money, out of the fund. Every year it takes $8 billion, no matter what oil price is doing. That would help. Mm-hmm. When the price of oil is $110 a barrel, that fund would get bigger. When the price of oil is $53 a barrel, that fund would get smaller. But every year, the state government would spend the same amount of money. People at UAA wouldn't have to worry about geopolitical conflict or lack thereof for our budget. And then you also mentioned the income tax. So I think the income tax could help, but I think that there's actually another benefit of an income tax. In addition to potentially helping minimize volatility, I think part of the problems that part of the problem that research-rich economies have is actually that they become the governments become dependent on resource-based revenue, right? So it's not a coincidence that Alaska doesn't have a state income tax, and Wyoming, and Texas, right? These states don't have income taxes because they substituted that revenue using resource-based revenue. And there is a prominent theory in political scientists and economics that actually taxation is necessary for there to be adequate democratic representation, right? So if we're not paying the bills for the expenditures for government, well, the government doesn't feel obliged to do what we want. If we're not having our income taxed, then we don't pay attention maybe to what the government's doing or as much attention as we should. So the key here, part of the story is that money is not fungible, right? It matters how you get it. So if the government takes my income and then says that they want to use it to build a gas pipeline, I might view that differently than if they take some of my oil money and use that to build a gas pipeline, right? So I think that there's broader implications of instituted income tax beyond minimizing volatility that it could help politically and could help something else you mentioned, address the some of the arguably bad policies that have been implemented in the past here.
As your campaign advisor, I will tell you the income tax will not help you politically. It may, but one other
Agreed.
Quick question. So I'm reading an interview with you, and you talk about one of the problems in Alaska. We don't have a manufacturing sector. You can't buy it, but we keep trying to buy a manufacturing sector. We keep trying to create industry. Are we alone, or have other nations suffering under the same resource curse, if you will, as Alaska, try to buy their way into manufacturing that's uneconomic?
So I'm not sure that we can buy our way into it. It's possible that it just is something that needs to happen organically. So that's an open question whether or not we could engineer that. I will say that we didn't have a manufacturing sector in Alaska before oil, and we don't really have one now. But I don't know that that's the key for growth either. So the U.S. is not, we produce a fraction of the manufacturing products that we used to. We've become much more of a service industry. Right, so I think the key for Alaska might be in services and less so in manufacturing.
Okay, that's enough for me. Questions from the audience? Right here in the middle. And when I call on you, someone will get you a microphone.
Thank you. As a fellow UAA professor, I feel your pain when it comes to, I'm actually a professor of Japanese history, and one of the things that I note is that when the leaders of Japan began the project of creating a modern Japanese state in 1868, one of the very first things they did was to figure out that basing the national budget on the fluctuating market price of a single commodity, in their case rice, was a really bad idea, and they should stop doing it. So,
yeah, they're a step ahead of us.
But one of the interesting aspects about this debate has been, first of all, if it's not one resource, it's another for Alaska. That is, oil is not the only primary commodity that we are inclined to extract. And indeed, Alaska's economy has kind of lived and died with various economies, primary resources. But there is also kind of the famous notion that Alaskans don't necessarily care how they do it outside.
We don't want to learn from others.
And I think one of the problems that we're having here is that the outside might not really care how we do it in Alaska. It's going to impose this on us anyway. So how do you try and make that case that, you know, this is not something that's really kind of up to us? This is kind of outside force majeure is going to actually require us to make some choices.
That's an example of a question I feared I would get. I don't have a great answer for that, though. I don't know that I buy the premise that it's that we need an outside force. I think that change will come when we decide. Again, not we, you guys really, but when Alaskans decide to make a change, make a shift, and I suspect that decision will be made when we're forced to. Which might not be too far in the future.
Right, we had talked about that before, that we may only make a change when we're forced to because we screwed it up so bad and the economy has so many problems. So, next, right behind him.
Yeah, thank you. I'm kind of curious on your chart where you showed that Alaska income might have been better had we not had the resources. And I'm wondering if you've adjusted for population in that, because if what you're talking about is per person income, that would have been affected dramatically by the fact that the completion of the oil pipeline and so on dramatically increased the size of the population of Alaska. Whereas if we really never had that oil boom, the population probably would have been far more stagnant. So statistically, isn't the increase in the size of the population as big of a driver as the actual detriments that maybe occur through expenditure of revenues?
Yeah. So make sure everybody heard that okay. The question was about the role of population and migration in the effect that would have on this figure here, my estimate of what income per capita would have been in the absence of Prudhoe Bay. And I'm glad you asked that. I didn't have time to go into details about this, but I think immigration is actually playing a key role in this figure, right? So when I first got this estimate, I was surprised. As you guys know, I in my opening statement, I said I'm a resource curse skeptic. I expected to find long-run economic benefits in Alaska, and when I didn't, I did what economists do. I thought about why I didn't get the result I thought I was going to get, and then I justify it and theorize about why I got that, right? So, but I actually think, in retrospect, this is exactly the result I should have expected to get. Because what happened when, let me put it this way, what would we all do in this room if the wage rate in Seattle was $1 million, or say salaries were $1 million a year? What would we all do? We'd all move to Seattle, right? And I'm right now teaching supply and demand to my students. If you increase the supply, that drives down the price, in this case, the price of labor. So when the pipeline was built and when oil started to flow, average income levels boomed in Alaska, and that attracted thousands of workers and thousands of people from around the country and around the world, not just people that were going to work in the oil industry, but people that are going to provide a variety of services and things like this. So these people show up in Alaska, and then production starts to dwindle. But just like me, I predict that a lot of these people that came up here in the 70s in search of, you know, maybe an Alaskan adventure and high income, they thought, oh, this place is sweet. There's, you know, grizzly bears and salmon and glaciers for now. And they decided to stay. So we got this shrinking pie, but an artificially elevated population. And in fact, if I had found that the average income level remained elevated in the long run, that would have been the surprising result, because you would have scratched your head and thought, why didn't people show up until salaries or wage rates were equated across states, right? And so I think another important thing here is, so you're right, this is only average income level. So if I pluck an average person, a random person off the street in Alaska, their income is probably about where it would have been had we not discovered oil. But we do have more people, I think, because of that. And there's a variety of benefits that come along with that, right? So I think the thing that I like so much about Alaska is that I can go fishing down in Bird Creek or go for a hike in Chugach, pronunciation, good. And then I can go to Hearth for dinner or go to Bubbly Mermaid for champagne, right? So we have an urban environment and we can go be a mountain man on the weekend or whatever. And the reason we can do both is because we have that population base. So there's agglomeration effects. There's more entertainment services and dining services, but there's also more flights. There's cheaper flights. There's more healthcare services, et cetera. And so there is a broader menu of potential benefits that oil has provided. And I specifically and narrowly focused on the effect on average income. Does that answer your question? Or okay.
Okay, we got a question here in the corner. No, you need a mic. You need a mic.
You mentioned education, so I'm curious if you can talk more about that and specifically what you've learned about looking at the outcomes in Alaska and maybe explain what your observations were.
Yeah. Okay, good question. So I mentioned earlier that resource-dependent economies have been linked to bad education outcomes. I haven't done Alaska-specific research on this topic. I plan to, I'm starting to, but I don't have any results to share with you. But I am familiar with the literature, and I've done some research on the link between natural resources and education outcomes in the lower 48. And what I have found is that there's a supply side and a demand side of the education system. So the extraction of natural resources could affect one or the other or both. So think about on the demand side. If there is a coal boom or a gold rush and wages are raised above what they used to be, what are some high school seniors going to do? They're going to take off. They're not going to graduate. They're going to go work. They're going to go dig up gold or work in the oil fields or the coal mine. And that's fine as long as they can accurately predict their ability to go back to school, right? So if they underestimate the likelihood of starting a family, getting a house, a car payment, they might not be able to go back to school once that resource is exhausted or once the mine closes. So you could find yourself in the long run in a bad situation in that context. And there's some good evidence that this happens in the United States. So specifically in Appalachia coal, coal region of Appalachia, we find that during the coal boom of the 1970s, high school dropout rates rose. And then during the coal bust, high school dropout rates decreased, right? So kind of an intuitive result. Now, there's also the supply side, right? So across countries, natural resources have been argued to resource-rich countries have been argued to underfund education, but a lot of that purported evidence, I think, is explained by some of the statistical issues I mentioned. Now, within the United States, there's for a while people believed that actually U.S. states spent very little on education, that universities and K-12 schools were underfunded, and my first year arriving up here at UAA. I was scratching my head thinking about this because I had previously lived in Wyoming for 5 years and I moved to Alaska and I just thought, man, it seems like these places spend a lot on education. And yet it appears, according to the literature, that these places, that education's underfunded. And what I found is that actually some of that research, suffered from a couple of different problems. One was that one notable paper inadvertently examined only private education expenditures, not total or public education expenditures. And in fact, what I found is that private education expenditures are 40% lower in resource-rich states than compared to resource-poor ones. But public education expenditures is through the roof, right? And the net effect is actually more education spending. So I think across U.S. states, and I would put Alaska in this category, though again, I haven't specifically looked at Alaska data, that education, a lot of money is spent on education, and I think that's a good thing. But we still can see these kind of temporary shocks where high school students might decide to forego college education or a high school diploma because of the opportunities provided by natural resources.
We've got a question in the far back, and then we'll get one up here. Yeah, wait till you get the mic.
Hi. When you talked about spending on education, is there any kind of, has there been any kind of analysis on the difference between education, public education spending, and education outcomes? Are those related? Are they the same?
Still being debated. Some studies find that more spending equals better quality. Some studies don't find that. So more work needs to be done.
Okay, we got a question here, and then I'll get that one next.
So I have to bring up the obvious. So Alaska is an owner state, and we have a permanent fund dividend. Could you speak a little bit more to, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, that we have one of the smaller income inequality gaps of most states in the U.S., and so could you speak to how that plays into income levels as well as engagement? Because we, you know, you did mention the income tax and that sort of dynamic of people being engaged, but my understanding is the dividend was also supposed to be implemented for that purpose.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well, that part of the role of the dividend is to get people engaged with what the government's doing to make sure they have skin in the game and taking a look at what's going on. And then you also, broadly your question is about the role of the dividend and specifically the effect that it has on maybe income inequality in the state. Yeah. So yeah, that includes the PFD. Yeah.
Does it include the back pay we're going to get?
No, it does not.
Okay. And see, you got to work on those political answers.
Yeah. So I don't know the relationship between the PFD and income inequality. My guess is that it helps to alleviate some income inequality. I think that, you know, again, if I was governor and I was, say, Governor Walker, and I was in a, you know, I've got revenues and I've got expenditures and I got to make these things match, I would have been inclined to, instead of cutting the PFD in half for everybody. Because that's quite regressive, right? There are people, especially people in rural parts of Alaska, that really depend on these dividend checks for their way of life, for survival, right? And so cutting that, I think, was very painful for a lot of people. It wasn't painful for faculty of CBPP, right? So some people were not happy about it, I'm sure. But I guess if I was governor, I would have tried to implement a cut for the top income earners, maybe the wealthiest.
So
half.
A needs-based dividend.
Needs-based.
That's
yes,
the end of your political career.
Right. Yeah, I know. So I would support a policy like that because of inequality and the uneven effect that it might have.
Okay, got one here, and then we'll get there next.
Do any of these models take into account whether the government is relatively corrupt and a lot of the money's being shaved off at the top, like Mexico, Venezuela, Nigeria,
yeah.
Or it's Norway.
Yeah. So I'm not sure I understood the question. I think it was the effect of political corruption on the growth performance of resource-rich economies?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So there's been lots of work across countries on the role, relationships between natural resource wealth and political corruption. And political corruption itself has been linked to a wide variety of bad outcomes, including slow growth. So in the United States, political corruption has been also linked to things like more relaxed environmental regulations, lower state bond ratings, and key slow economic growth. Now, there has not been a lot of research done within the U.S. states on the effect of resource wealth on political corruption. I'm currently working on that project. What I can say is that what I've discovered so far is that if I look at states that have produced the most oil and gas from the late 70s to today, these states suffer from political corruption. They're measured as convictions of of corruption by the Federal Department of Justice. And the leader is Alaska, measured as convictions of political corruption per worker, or sorry, per person or per government employee, either way. Now, that does not mean, there's a correlation there, that does not mean that the natural resources are causing the corruption, right? It could be that sparsely populated states are more likely to experience political corruption because newspaper reporters live far away from the Capitol building, right? It's possible. And if oil just happens to be located in sparsely populated states, then we would inadvertently blame oil for the political corruption. But I can say that, you know, we can have a debate about the causal effect, but I can say that the oil-rich U.S. states are more politically corrupt. And that should have, according to theory and empirical evidence, a deleterious effect on economic growth.
Okay. Well, let's... Okay. But let's... try to share the questions. We got one here, and then we'll work our way across.
Thank you. I just want to go back. You said that, if I understood you right, if you plucked any of us off the street and asked us what our income, or essentially you're saying our income would be the same, or your estimate, without oil, if you plucked us off the street today. Is that what you said?
On average.
On average. I just beg to differ. I mean, where do you get that estimate of income? What's producing that income? Are we selling dog sled tours? Were we getting that estimated income from selling trinkets to tourists or mm-hmm. fur or fishing? Mm-hmm. I mean, where's the income? What's supporting your estimate of income
okay.
besides oil?
Great question. So the question was, how could it possibly be that the average income level in Alaska today would be equal to what it is without oil? What would we have done to create that wealth, right? So part of that question gets back to one of the earlier questions, which is the role of migration. Without oil, we wouldn't have so many people. And without so many people, we don't need as many jobs. And so the key difference here is the difference between GDP, or state GDP, and the GDP per person, right? Additionally, it's hard to imagine how the state would have evolved in the absence of oil, right? We just see today, or maybe, you know, Alaska with oil, and we think it's just not possible that anything could have substituted for this. But I beg to differ that it is possible that things would have substituted. So you know, just for example, I find that the miles of paved road in Alaska increased by 2,600 miles from 1960 to 1970. Right, so that's a decade before oil. Now, from 1970 to 1980, during this big oil boom and all this money's coming in, guess how much miles of paved road increased by? About 2,600 miles. Right, and so one possible explanation is that oil money that's funding road construction may be substituted for what the federal government would have been paying. I don't know that, but this is an example of where the financing might have come from. Maybe that oil revenue is substituting for other things, including maybe federal dollars. Maybe we would have concentrated more on, you know, how do we capitalize on tourism? I'm not saying that we can substitute the oil sector today with tourism, but I think that there is a certain amount of complacency that comes with this free lunch. That we're not forced to think hard about what are our various other opportunities to make money.
Okay, we got a lot of people thinking with questions. We got one here, and then I'll go over here.
Hi, thank you. When I think about, you're talking about the long-term effects of oil extraction, that makes me think of climate change. And when, in the case that climate change is going to have a very severe impact on our state before the oil runs out, so I was wondering, have you seen other countries or other states that have used their resource wealth to transition off of fossil fuels to renewable energy before all of their resources ran out?
So has an energy fossil fuel rich economy ever successfully switched off fossil fuels completely to renewables before they're actually forced to do that? I I don't know of an example for that. We do have a Nobel Prize winning environmental economist here tonight that might be better suited to answer that question, but I don't know what would be the good example of that. California is actually an incredibly fossil fuel rich state, and it's moving in that direction. Norway could be another example that gets close. The Dutch possibly, yeah. So we're a bit out of my wheelhouse here, but I think some economies have probably gotten closer, or getting closer. But it's not a great answer.
Got a question here.
So one of the unique things about Alaska is that our two biggest, it seems to me, our two biggest resources is oil and fishing, and a large percentage of the workers are actually live out of state in both those industries. How does that impact? It seems like it would just multiply what you're talking about.
So the energy industry employs a lot of people, a lot of non-Alaskans.
A lot of non-Alaskans as well as does the fishing industry.
Yeah.
Our two biggest resources, yeah. I think.
So I think one of the big problems that resource-rich economies face, and that Alaska faces as well, is drainage. That this money's being made, the rents are being made, and they're leaving state in part because we're employing people that live in Oregon, and they come up for the summer and they take their cash home, right? So that is a problem, and I think it's reasonable to try to think hard about policies to address that. I don't have a great proposal other than
income tax.
Possibly an income tax. Yeah. Income tax, sales tax. There's also higher local laws that could potentially be reasonable in this situation.
Okay. Got a question in the back here.
I'm wondering to what extent you looked at, I mean, you're talking about average income increases as a result of oil revenues. I've been in Alaska just a year, but I used to work in eastern Montana, and I was there during the Bakken oil boom, so I've experienced firsthand some of the externalities of natural resource development. And I guess from personal experience and some of my reading, one of the things that I've considered is not just at the personal level, but at the government level, the unequal distribution of wealth that results from natural resource development. And so there's people that become millionaires overnight, and there's people that leave their jobs and go make $1 million and retire in 5 years, and then there's the rest of us. At the state level, I saw the same kinds of uneven distribution of wealth from oil revenues. So the state may take in revenues from royalties, but local governments absorb the externalities of increased crime, no infrastructure development, no increase in property taxes. So I'm wondering to what degree you look at balancing the other externalities that have costs against average income from oil revenues, and also whether there are better investment possibilities, rather than distributing a PFD, for example, $2,000 to every individual, long-term investment in the state infrastructure that would help absorb the long-term impact when all of those migrating workers go home to Florida, Texas, whatever, when the boom stops. Yeah. And the mess is left behind on local governments. So that's my question.
Okay, so that was a lot. I'll do my best to respond here. Maybe we can talk more afterwards if I don't get to everything. But the broadly speaking, the concern was about externalities associated with resource extraction. So there's a bunch of different externalities, right? So environmental degradation, air pollution, water pollution is one. It's gotten a lot of attention with fracking down in the lower 48. But there's other issues, right? So that increased risk of water contamination has been shown to depress housing prices down in the lower 48. There's also been, I've written a study on the effect of the shale boom down the lower 48 on criminal activity, on crime. And there's significant clear effects. And there's a direct cost associated with that criminal activity. I actually estimated it to be about $2 million in the average shale-rich county. It's a small percentage of the total income gains, about 2% for the average place. But it's one externality among many. And there's also potentially long-run effects of this. If somebody moves to North Dakota, I'm not really sure why they'd move to North Dakota, but no offense, I'm just kidding. But somebody moves to North Dakota, they did so not because they don't want to live in the city. They like that rural environment, right? And the low crime rate. And when it's no longer safe, when they have to start locking their doors, when they're getting their cars stolen, some of them are going to leave. And which are the ones that are going to leave? It's the people that can leave. The better off are going to leave. It's the people that are going to leave are the ones that happened to own property above an oil field that collected a $20,000 a month check and moved to Florida, right? And so, again, talking about the drainage of these rents and these benefits that are potentially offered to a resource-rich economy that are lost by not maybe adequately taxing the extracting firm, not adequately taxing income, trying to get some of this revenue to stick locally. So I think I agree.
Can we keep it short questions? Because we got
to
end now.
Sure. I wanted to go back to the slide where you show that for one outcome, it's similar to what you projected over the long run. But there are other outcomes, obviously, things like health outcomes, education you mentioned you hadn't studied, transportation, maintaining rural way of life. So I guess the way I think of the resource curse is it's more than just income, and I wanted you to comment on that. Thanks.
Agreed. Agreed. And I haven't done a broader analysis yet. I'm working on it, but, I'm only one member of a small department, we're working on these questions and we will get to them. But I will say for now that the life expectancy rate in Alaska in 1960 was, I believe, 66. And the life expectancy for the average American was 67. And by 1980, the average life expectancy in Alaska was 70. And that for the United States was also 70. This is for males, male life expectancy. I didn't have the data for females, sorry. Based off of that, it's not unreasonable to think that life expectancy might have been unaffected. We could also look at poverty. So the poverty rate in Alaska in 1960 was a whopping 20%, 19.5% maybe, but close to 20%. One out of five people in Alaska were living in poverty. In Mississippi in 1960, the poverty rate was closer to 50%. And in fact, half the states in the United States had a poverty rate in excess of 20% in 1960. From 1960 to 1970, the poverty rate in Alaska fell from 20% to 12%. And then from 1970 to 1980, the period of which oil was extracted, the poverty rate fell 2%. So I think some people will say, poverty was alleviated because of oil. You go back to 1960, a large part of the United States was in poverty, living in pretty poor conditions. By and large, we've all grown out of that poverty, but not all of us had oil. So a lot of places did it without the natural resources.
Okay, I've been told we've got to wrap this up. So a very short question. You teach in addition to doing research, right?
Yeah.
If the state of Alaska had been your student or was your student for the last 40 years, what grade would you give us for handling our resource wealth? And you got to give us a grade. This is not a pass-fail class.
So grades are relative things.
For those of us who had them, they were relative, yeah. But you got to give us a grade. Is this the professor or the candidate thinking?
Yeah. I'd actually do probably a B, B minus. I think the wealth fund was critical. That was awesome. I actually think that the PFD is a good idea. We have a really big state. If we take all of that oil revenue and we fund UAA with it, well, all the people living out in other parts of Alaska, that's more than two times the size of Texas, as we all know, they might not see a lot of those benefits. And so I think we've done some things that were really good.
Hey, I can live with a B minus.
Yeah.
Better than I ever had. The closing. Thank you.
I'd like to thank our governor for, 2023, Dr. Alexander James, and Larry Pursley back to the stage, and we hope to have you again soon. Thank you very much for that interesting conversation. It's something that I know we're going to be talking about for a while. So all of you, please keep the conversation going, and we really appreciate our speakers. We have a little gift of appreciation from our board of directors, a little bit of Alaska World Affairs Council swag, with our new logo representing the next 60 years of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and hope you carry it proudly and encourage other people to come back. For all of you who want to come to our next programs, please register early. As you see today, we were sold out. We snuck in an extra 10, 15 people in the back to make it happen, but it looks like our next programs are going to be the exact same. So please register early. We'll give you the code for free parking with Easy Park and get you a seat. And so with that, thank you very much for coming. If you don't mind recycling your name tag, leaving them at the front desk, that'll be great, and we'll see you next week.
Good answer on the grade.
Got me off guard there a little bit.